The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So today I thought I'd talk a little bit about simplicity. As we hear the teachings, we listen to the teachings of the Buddha. There's all these lists. There's the Four Noble Truths, the Five Aggregates, the Five Faculties, the Seven Factors of Enlightenment, the Eightfold Path, the Ten Paramis. There's all of these lists and teachings associated with all of the lists, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And the way our minds work, I think, particularly in our culture, is that we feel like we have to have the knowledge of all of the teachings. We hear about all these things and we feel like, well, it's really important to have this knowledge, to understand these teachings in order to be able to practice, to meditate. There's different. There's all the teachings. And then there's all these different practices as well. The Four Foundations of Mindfulness is the teaching of mindfulness, but in the teaching of the mindfulness of body alone, I think there are 9 different practices that the Buddha offers. So it can be kind of complicated, and we can make it complicated in a way also by feeling like we have to take it all in and understand it all. So I'd like to just address this a little bit. I think, in our culture, knowledge and information is really idolized. And it seems like we think that is the pinnacle of what we can know, is having knowledge and having information. And the perspective of the practice actually isn't so much about information as it is about experience. So we do need some information. I mean, the main teaching of the Buddha is around mindfulness in terms of practice. This is the main core teaching. Wise attention, he talks about. And yet, if we were simply to just take this understanding or this teaching of be aware, if we just simplified it to that, just be aware. If you were to go out onto the street and tell somebody who hadn't had any context of what these teachings are about, and just said, be aware of what happens to you, most likely transformation around the awareness is not going to happen. Because when they're aware, if you say, okay, so be aware of your anger. Be aware of your struggles. Well, what happens when people are aware of those things, if they don't have a context to understand it, is that they're just going to get pulled in to those and repeat the same patterns over and over again. So simply being aware isn't quite enough. We do need some information. We need a little bit of wisdom. And then there's all these teachings of the Buddha, these masses of texts that give the wisdom of the Buddha and the practices. And so do we need to know all of that before we start to practice? And I'd like to say, actually, no, we don't. That, one thing I like to think of is that, the wisdom of the Buddha, every bit of the wisdom that the Buddha teaches touches every other bit of the wisdom. It's this incredibly interlocked, interwoven, interfolded teaching. such that if you start with any one little piece of it and bring that to bear with awareness, the practice will unfold. I like to think of the Buddha's wisdom, the wisdom of the Buddha as being really dense. You know, it's like the most incredible dark chocolate truffle, you know. You just need this tiny little bit of it to get this incredible burst of flavor on your tongue. You know, that the wisdom of the Buddha, you actually just need a little bit of it. A little bit of it goes a long way. I'd like to describe an experience that I had when I first started my practice to kind of elucidate this. It's an example of an experience that many of you have heard several times, but I'm not sure I've talked about it quite from this perspective too many times. So when I first started my practice, I was in the Peace Corps in the South Pacific. And there wasn't a lot of Dharma in the South Pacific. I had, somebody had sent me a book on meditation and mindfulness. The book was Everyday Zen by Joko Beck. And I had a lot of suffering. So I was interested in understanding my suffering. I'd kind of hit bottom. It's like, well, nothing else has worked. Maybe this mindfulness stuff will work. And so I read this book, and you know, going back and looking in that book, it covers the teachings pretty well, but you know, I didn't understand much of it. But there was one little bit that that kind of stuck with me. And it was, you know, okay, so be mindful of your experience, but it wasn't just be mindful. The piece that kind of stuck with me was, if you're struggling with emotion, if you're having difficult emotions, try just simply being aware of it instead of acting on it. So this is pointing to turning towards a feeling as opposed to being engaged in the world around the feeling. So this was the little bit of wisdom that I took out of that book. And I decided, okay, well, anger is what's my problem, and anger is what I'm struggling with, so I'll try paying attention to my anger and not acting on it, meaning not continue to think thoughts about it, I didn't actually think of it in those terms, but, you know, not engaging with it, just turning to meet it. And so I did this. I did this for a couple of months. And, you know, when I first started doing it, it's kind of like, well, what do I do with this? You know, it's like I didn't really understand what it meant to be mindful. But about all I could do was recognize, yes, I'm angry. Well, I'm angry. Okay, well, I'm angry. That's about all I could do, is just recognize that anger was present. I didn't have much in the way of instructions about turning to the body. It took me years before I really understood about paying attention to the body. I didn't have much experience. I didn't have much in the way of teachings about, you know, how the thoughts. I mean, I kind of knew intuitively that the thoughts were in making the anger worse, but I didn't have much teaching about, you know, how to let go of the thoughts. So, you know, when I came into mindfulness around the anger, it's like, okay, yes, I see that I'm angry, but what does it even mean to be mindful of this? I didn't know. And it's like, okay, well, I guess I go back to work. And so I would go back to work. And over the course of several months of looking at this, I began to notice a shift in the pattern. I noticed that just through this recognition, oh, I'm angry, and going back to work. Essentially what that is a meeting of the anger and a putting aside. You know, meet it, put it aside, meet it, put it aside, over and over again, meet it, put it aside, meet it, put it aside. And what that did for me over the course of months was that I began to become aware of the anger earlier in the process. And so I began to see there was some space around the anger. All of this, I saw some benefits of the practice just from this very simple thing of turn to the anger and don't act on it. Turn to the anger and don't act on it. So it was very simple wisdom that I was working with. And yet it created so much more ease in my life through that very simple practice. And then some months into this whole process, and this is a story many of you have heard, you know, I was in my kitchen and cutting an apple and just fine, no problem, but I saw a thought appear in my mind. Saw a thought of being with the person I was angry with. And the thought was related to the apple. I was at a fruit stand with this person. And I could see in my mind that there was this very strong urge to think more thoughts in order to get angry at that person. I wasn't yet angry, but I could see that impulse, that urge towards anger. And in the seeing of that urge towards anger, the mind, I didn't do this. This was not something I tried to do. The mind looked at that and said, not going to go there. Not going to get angry. Not going to head in that direction. And my understanding of why the mind did that was because I had spent months waking up in the middle of anger and feeling the suffering of it. Feeling directly how painful it was for me to be angry. And in this process too, I had seen that in that anger, there was this wish or this belief in a way that somehow this anger would hurt the person that I was angry with. And that, you know, that was kind of what I was focused on, wanting to hurt that person. But I had seen directly that it hurt me. This is the first and second noble truths that I witnessed. I didn't know what that was. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I wasn't thinking, oh, this is the first noble truth, this is the second noble truth. I wasn't thinking in those terms. I was trying to do this very simple practice of letting go, of just meeting the anger and not acting on it. So the mind didn't go to that anger. And that moment was so powerful for me because what it really pointed out to me was how powerful the tool of mindfulness was with this little bit of wisdom. These two together, this little bit of wisdom and the mindfulness. Very powerful. I saw, essentially, that anger did not come into my mind in that moment. This was mind-blowing for me. You know, that I could think of this person and not get angry? It was revelatory that that was even possible. So this, and the power of the practice really, really came home to me in that moment. So this practice that I had been engaging in, you know, in retrospect, looking back on it, I can point to teachings around karma, I can point to teachings around intention and how we don't have to follow through on the intention, how intention arises out of, you know, habit. You know, the intention towards anger, that's what I saw, the intention towards, you know, the habit of the mind leaping on a thought about that person and getting angry. That was an intention. I saw that we don't have to act on intentions, that mindfulness of intentions can lead to the letting go of unskillful intentions. I directly saw the suffering of unwholesome states of mind, of anger. So I can talk about this example from many different Dharma perspectives, but I didn't know all those Dharma perspectives when that moment happened. So, you know, the most important thing is to, you know, have a little bit of understanding, have a little bit of this shift of perspective. I mean, basically what the Buddha talks about is shifting our perspective on the world. We think we're going to find happiness through certain ways of acting. And the Buddha kind of turns it around and says, you know, you're not going to find happiness by trying to get what you want. You'll just get that thing and then you'll be worried about losing it. Or if you don't get it, you'll be sad because you didn't get it. Or if you get it and you have it and it goes, then you're sad because it goes. So he turns the way we have learned over the course of our lives to construct these little tiny moments of happiness and says, you know, that's not actually doing it for you. In fact, it's making it worse. Because we just recondition this wanting to have things in a certain way. We recondition that over and over again. So just a little bit of, you've all heard teachings, many, many teachings. Which ones resonate? You know, connect with those and practice with those. We don't need to keep the whole structure of the Dharma in our mind as we practice. So practice can be really simple. So the wisdom of the Buddha, I'd like to just kind of summarize from my perspective the key elements of the wisdom of the Buddha. And there are two. There is that suffering is present and that it's helpful to understand it. That as opposed to trying to fix it or change it, to turn towards the process that's happening around suffering and see if we can understand what's happening in our own minds around the suffering. That's one of the perspectives that the Buddha brings. It's helpful to understand suffering. The other perspective is around cause and effect. That when we act in a certain way, it has an impact. That it's not that things don't happen randomly for us. So that actions have consequences. And understanding this in our direct experience, what action did I take? How am I experiencing the consequences? That's another piece that is helpful for us to use in our bringing our mindfulness to our experience. I just like to say, too, I mean, there's all of these teachings. And, you know, we bring our mindfulness to our experience. And sometimes we can meet it. We can just turn our attention to our anger, like I did, you know. There's this anger. And it's like, well, what do I do with this? I don't know what I do with this. I have no idea what to do with this. Okay, I guess I go on with my work. That very simple practice of recognizing and moving on was incredibly powerful. And there are a lot of ways, I think a lot of what the Buddha describes are essentially tools for helping us when we struggle with meeting our experience. So we get overwhelmed by patterns. We get lost in our thoughts around a particular struggle. And so a lot of what the Buddha teaches are just kind of different ways to go at the difficulty. So, you know, what I like to suggest, you know, as I said, you know, find one that resonates for you. If for you the practice of cultivating metta, of bringing in the quality of metta resonates, use that in your attention. If for you the practice of meeting suffering resonates, this understanding, you know, meet your difficulty without acting on it, go with that. So so I think he comes at it from many different perspectives, partly because there's so many different minds out there and so many different ways that people take things in. So how does it work? I mean, it seems kind of amazing to me that this little bit of shift of perspective plus awareness transforms us. And it does transform us. So my understanding, again, if I go back to that example I just gave, the little bit of shift of perspective around suffering and understanding suffering. Now, what happens to us as we do that, we get it that when we have these difficulties, that we are the ones that are suffering. And we deeply understand how those states of mind impact us. So much we are oriented towards the world and how we can fix or change or manipulate the world, that we're not really noticing the impact of our wanting and our hating and our pushing away and fixing and controlling and changing. We're not noticing the impact that it has on us until it gets so bad that we've got ulcers or something. You know, then we start to notice it. But we can notice. We can notice it as we turn to our experience. We see that even a little bit of irritation creates a suffering in our own experience. And as the mind starts to see that what it's doing is making this being suffer, it starts to let go of those patterns of agitation, worry, anxiety. It starts to let them go because it sees that it's doing it to itself. You know, we're built this way, actually. We are built to not want to suffer. Our whole system is designed to try to create this, you know, sense of balance and ease in our experience, you know, in our inner landscape, kind of. You know, we're hungry, we need to eat, you know, that kind of, our whole system is designed to create this balance inside. And somehow, you know, we get confused and deluded about what that inner balance is. And we think that having what we want is as good as it gets. So when the mindfulness begins to penetrate into the area of how our own thoughts, our own emotions impact this inner landscape, this inner balance, the mind, not wanting to suffer, begins to reorient and begins to let go of some of the ways that we create that difficulty for ourselves. So this is a process. It's a slow process. And part of what this practice of just, you know, the simplicity of just being willing to meet our lives with this orientation of turning towards the experience as opposed to manipulating the world, it changes us, but it doesn't like do it like that. It's a process, an unfolding. You know, that story that I talked about, it was months of observing the anger and noticing. I mean, one of the good things about this practice is that if you are engaging in it, you will start to notice benefits pretty quickly. I think many of you have experienced that I noticed pretty quickly that I wasn't getting as angry. You know, it was easier to be with the anger as I paid attention to it over time. And it was months before I saw that kind of moving towards the anger and the ability to, you know, that the mind had to just let it go. And it was years that I continued to observe that pattern. You know, that one moment of seeing, oh, I don't have to go there. You know, that was a rare insight. You know, it didn't mean the pattern of anger went away forever. It went on for years, and I continued this practice of meeting it, and slowly over years it wore away. There's an analogy that the Buddha gives around the practice of it's kind of like if you have bits of a ship that's been in a shipwreck and the ship is lying on the beach. The sun, the sand, the wind, the water wear away at the parts of the ship slowly over time. You know, each day to day, if you go and look at the parts of the ship on the beach, you're not going to see much difference in that bit of rope or that bit of wood. But coming back a year later or 2 years later, they'll be very different. And if you go to pick up a bit of rope, you'll see it just falls apart. And the mindfulness of something over and over again kind of works that way. It just kind of moves in and begins to shift it kind of from the inside and weaken the fibers of that struggle, weaken the fibers of that pattern. And we don't have to do it. We don't have to. I mean, again, you know, the simplicity of this is that it happens. I think partly because we're built this way, because the mind wants to move towards happiness. So the mindfulness begins to kind of break apart those fibers, those patterns, those habits. And 2 years, 3 years, 5 years down the road, we can look back and see, oh, you know, for myself now, this person that I was so angry with, now it's about 15 years ago, there is no trace of it left. It is gone. And I never actually saw it go away. It just slowly wore out. I do remember at one point reflecting, wow, I haven't experienced that in a long time. I wonder what happened to it. And checking at that moment, I could no longer find it. Even bringing up the thought of that person in my mind, I could not even construct that anger anymore. So this practice does transform us. But it takes a little bit of trust. The trust to be willing to be simple with our experience, to just turn and meet it, the trust that this transformation happens and we don't necessarily see how it's changing moment to moment or day to day or even week to week. But we can look back 10 years, 5 years, 2, 3 years of practice and we can start to see, oh yeah, you know, if this had happened to me 3 years ago, I know I would have been really upset about it. And now, well, it's just a little bit of a bother. You know, it's not such a big deal anymore. And maybe 5 years out or 10 years out, it's like it doesn't even register anymore, that particular difficulty. It's just so much let go of. So sometimes it can help to take in those moments of recognizing, oh, wow, you know, this isn't bothering me as much as it used to. Because that supports the sense of trust. It supports the trust that this very gentle practice and very simple, associated with this, the simplicity of a little bit of wisdom, that it does transform us. See if I have anything more in my notes to mention. I guess just one piece, and that is mindfulness and the meeting of experience. And it's like just the repeated, it's the repeating of it over and over again that brings the power to the mindfulness. The willingness to over and over again meet the same pattern over and over again. There's one teacher, I can't remember which one, but who talks about small moments many times. Just meet this moment. That's all we can do, is meet this moment. And just meet as much as you can, each moment, over and over again. Turning towards the experience, the inner landscape of experience, instead of being oriented on what's out there. That will transform you. Just over and over again. So I want to open it up for comments or questions or thoughts. Yeah, in the back. Okay. And can you use the mic?
Just the definition of, did you say metta?
Metta is loving kindness.
Metta is loving kindness, okay.
And you know, it's a quality, you know, this is one way that we can see how, you know, all the teachings kind of interconnected. The metta is a quality that we can cultivate. We can, you know, the metta quality is a quality of connectedness, of well-wishing. It's not like, you know, somebody says, it's not like Hallmark greeting card kind of love. It's much simpler, and it's more like kindness, more like just connectedness. And we can cultivate that quality through actively practicing and inclining the mind in that direction. And that quality is cultivated as we turn to meet our experience. You know, as we turn to meet our experience without judgment, that's another piece that's really helpful. I should bring that in too. As we meet our experience, one of the important bits of wisdom is that it's really helpful to notice not only what's happening in your experience, but how you are paying attention to it. So there is the you know, kind of what's in the back of your mind as you're paying attention to experience. So, you know, in meeting a struggle, in meeting a difficulty, if there's in the back of your mind, kind of unseen, this agenda to get rid of it or to fix it or change it, that's kind of imported the complication into the meditation itself. And so the, you know, one of the practices is to, you know, notice what's happening and notice how we are aware of it. You know, is there tension or tightness or wanting to change or fix or control what we are actually aware of? And if that's happening, to open to that as being also something that is going on in our experience, this slowly begins to open us to this kind of attention, this kind of awareness that is non-judgmental, that's non-reactive, that just can meet experience. And that quality of attention contains kindness. It contains friendliness to our own experience. And so, you know, you can move towards the cultivation of metta from the perspective of actively cultivating it, or the experience of metta just begins to unfold as we cultivate this mindfulness without the judgmental quality in our minds. So this is one, you know, so kind of, you know, coming at this from a couple of different ways. You know, we might hear the teaching about metta and think, oh, I need to do that. And it is cultivated as we bring attention to our experience. So So that was a bit more of an elaboration on your question. So I do want to just go back to this question about, that looking at the how we pay attention. There's all kinds of attitudes that we can have in our minds as we pay attention. And the simplest one can just be curiosity. What's happening? Can we just be curious about what's happening? If you notice, that you're, paying attention to something like knee pain or something, this is a real easy one to see this kind of thing, and you're paying attention to knee pain, and you're kind of forcing yourself to pay attention to that knee pain, that the awareness is kind of tight and holding on to that knee pain. And besides that, in the back of the mind is, I don't like this knee pain, I want it to go away. Why am I sitting in, why does this teaching say I have to not move? And so there's all of this stuff going on. There's struggling and suffering going on around how we are paying attention. So the teaching is around orienting towards where the suffering is happening. So in that case, the suffering is happening in the how we're paying attention. So noticing that, noticing the resistance, noticing the frustration, noticing the anger, the hostility towards the pain, that becomes what we turn to. So it's really simple, but it's not easy. It's not so easy to do this. One of my teachers, one of my Burmese teachers, he has a very simple description of the practice, and it's like, okay, you notice that you're aware, and then knowing that you're aware, what are you aware of? So that's the basics, noticing what's happening in your experience, and every now and then checking how you're paying attention. And that's his instruction, It's not very complicated. So we complicate things. We complicate things in so many ways. We complicate our relationship to the world because we, things are happening. There's something happening in our experience, and we don't like what's happening in our experience. And so we complicate things by trying to figure out what to do about that. The simpler thing is to just meet. Well, this is what's happened. How can I meet that? Now, that's not to say, the simplicity in talking about it in this simple way, it can easily be misunderstood that all we're supposed to do is sit like a lump on a log and never take any action. That's not what actually ends up happening in this. If you think I'm not supposed to do anything, you're actually adding yet another agenda in the back of your mind. So what happens to us as we notice our experiences, that we begin to uncover that there are all of these motivations of struggle and difficulty and fixing and changing and wanting and not wanting. And we see that those cause us suffering. And so it's not so helpful to act on those. But we also begin to see that there are beautiful qualities like kindness, like compassion, like balance of mind, like peace, like generosity. And there's a very natural movement to act on those. So it's not that we just end up sitting back. What happens as we start to meet our experience in this simple way is that the mind begins to tease apart what are helpful actions and what are unhelpful actions. What are things that are good to do and engage in, and what are things that are not so helpful? And metta, the quality of metta, and acting out of that quality of metta is one of those things that's helpful. So any other comments? No, it was a little riff off of metta. Did you have something? Use the mic.
You had talked about your experience 15 years ago of being very painful, and that now you don't think about it.
Well, that's not quite.
That it doesn't cause you the pain.
Yes.
It did. And so I thought about, I similarly had an experience like that caused me a great deal of pain and suffering. And I don't think about it now either. And then I thought about the old adage, time heals everything.
Yes.
And I thought, well, so I guess the question is, because of your practice now, do you feel if you had an experience similar to that, you're just better able to cope with it? I know the answer to it in a way, but...
Yes. The whole event that happened there was such a long, complicated process of getting into a relationship that really wasn't so good, and the extrication from that relationship was very painful. I think at this point, I wouldn't even go in. I wouldn't get myself in the situation anymore.
But I think just maybe generally that the practice, because I think it is true, time does heal everything. But it's, I suppose, how we deal with. Maybe it would have been less painful if you had some of the skills.
I think now. Yes, if I had the skills, it would have probably been less painful. And I think you're right. I mean, in some ways, the practice, time does heal things. And yet, so in thinking back on that difficulty that I had those years ago, at some point, and it was only, let's see, how long did it take? It was about 2000, 1996. So it was 4 years into that I had the recognition that what I felt when that person came into my mind was no longer anger, but love. When the spontaneously thoughts came into my mind, that love came into my mind. And that really blew me away, that this practice could transform me so much that not only did I no longer feel the hurt myself, but what I felt was an opening of my heart towards that person. And I did not know that was possible. I mean, yes, time heals, I had heard, but the fact that I could have a feeling of love towards this person when they had hurt me so badly, that was a surprise. That was about 4 years after the initial experience. So there is a deep letting go of the pain that can happen that I don't know ever would have been possible for me without the practice. I mean, maybe now I'd be able to think back on him and kind of, not be so angry. But I think there'd always be this little kind of, I just assumed there would always be this little, things aren't right there, Okay, I don't need to think about it. It was 15 years ago. But now it doesn't matter anymore. Thank you.
I know what you're talking about in terms of a relationship and anger and letting go, and I also had that thought about, well, time heals everything, but I had a similar experience with my own mother. There was a lot of anger about the way she led her life and sort of the situation she would drag my sister and I into in sort of this crazy life. And somehow in that situation, time healed it because I wasn't practicing Buddhism and a lot of therapy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But for the anger part, that totally speaks to me in a different situation, which is like the everyday family life that I'm in. And I find that oftentimes I do get angry, like getting the kids out of the door in the morning or at night, getting them ready for bed. And it's clinging to this expectation of wanting them to be these little Swiss soldiers and do things the way I expect them to do it, and them totally in their own imaginations and heads and being little 7-year-old boys. And so there's this back and forth pull, but I've had those moments where I've looked at one of them and I've just thought, okay, I'm so angry right now. I experience it in my body. I look at the upset child who knows I'm angry, and the anger has completely dissolved and gone away, and I feel total compassion. And it's such a wonderful experience. And so that's what I try for, and sometimes it happens, and sometimes it doesn't.
Yes.
And recently it's not happening because we're moving, so there's extra stress, so I'm like trying to be even more in control and have even more, you know, Swiss soldier type children. And so it just sort of, you know, it's not happening. And so this talk was very helpful to me, and I even thought of how I would have handled a situation last night differently. But and then another question I have for you is, in the midst of having those feelings last night, one of the kids looked up through the skylight and said, "Mommy, there's a dove sitting on this telephone wire, or this, you know, antenna right outside the skylight." And I looked at the dove and I thought, "That, do you know what a dove symbolizes?" And I told them that it symbolizes peace, and that's what we want to experience here. And it just kind of dissolved the anger again. Uh-huh. And I think in Buddhism, you don't look for signs, or you don't... How do you experience that in Buddhism? I don't know. The sort of fortuitous things that come your way as you're going down your path, and you think, oh, this is here to tell me something.
Uh-huh. That's a really interesting question. I mean, you know, that... the way I understand it, you know, we could look at it as, you know, the world has come together to give you this message or something. But the way I understand it is that, you know, our habits and patterns have taken us to meet the world in a moment in a particular way. And if we turn to look at how we are experiencing things, if we meet the world... I mean, there's often this thing, if we get the lessons that we need, that kind of a thing. Well, the reason we get the lessons that we need is that our minds and bodies are carrying along our suffering with us. And when we finally turn and stop to look at our experience, the lessons that we need are the suffering that's happening in this very moment. And if we can open our hearts to what's happening, we'll pull in wisdom from the very situation that we're in. So it's, you know, I think it's very natural in a way that we, you know, in opening our hearts, we see those kinds of things. But I don't personally believe that, you know, somehow the dove flew there because you needed to see a dove. I mean, maybe there would have been something else that could have dissolved it. You know, it was fortuitous that your son looked up and saw it. And that you could have met it in that moment is a sign of your deepening practice. I mean, 3 years ago, if your son had said that, might you have said, "We need to get on with things here, you know. We've got this box to pack. We've got this to do. You know, we don't have time to look at doves." So, you know, your openness brings you to the place where you can take in the wisdom that is around us. Yeah. Anyone else have any? Kumi? You want to use the mic?
So, briefly, what do you do with suffering when you suffer?
It's not so much doing as it is just witnessing. The first noble truth, the truth of suffering, the thing the Buddha suggests that we do about it is to understand it. And understanding means turning towards meeting it, feeling how it impacts you. You know, in my experience of that anger, the feeling how it impacted me, it's like it's an education of the mind. It's like when the mind is in this state, this is how it feels. And often it doesn't feel good. And that begins to educate the mind that state isn't so helpful. And, as I've said, you know, sometimes we get overwhelmed. You know, there are times when mindfulness, when suffering is stronger than our ability to be mindful. when a pattern or a habit or a, you know, the whole mess of our lives has taken us to a place where, you know, the suffering is stronger. Or as in your situation, now there's more happening, there's more stress. And so what's happening is a little bit stronger than your level of mindfulness. So it kind of challenges or stretches you a little bit. So in those times when we find that we're overwhelmed, we just do the best we can, and we learn. I mean, one of the things we need to really start to learn is, when do we need to not try to be mindful of a particular suffering? When are we overwhelmed by it? When does mindfulness actually take us back into the suffering? And when that happens, it's kind of like my, you know, being in that rage. It's like, oh, what do I do with this? I don't know what I do with this. I guess I go on with work. You know, that kind of just like put it aside and pay attention to something else. Learning when that is necessary for you, really, really helpful to honor and respect those the strength of those patterns, and when they when the mindfulness can't meet them. So the, you know, the simplicity of the instruction is turn to meet the suffering. Just notice how it impacts you. And if you see that you're overwhelmed, find some way to stay present. And not it's not a repression. What I'm talking about here is not a repression. It's not a pushing down. It's kind of a, okay, this is not so helpful. Let me turn my attention to something else. And in my case, I went back to my computer. I just went back to work. It's really just a turning towards and understand. So it's time to stop. So thank you all for your attention.